This is News in No Time. Ed Gordon on today's roundtable. The United Nations threatens to pull out of Darfur, Sudan, as violence mounts. That's just one of the topics we'll take on. Joining us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C., Karen Narasaki, President and Executive Director of the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium. Jeff Obafemi Carr joins us today. He's host of the radio show Freestyle. He joins us from Nashville, Tennessee, and at member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Nat Irvin, Professor of Future Studies at Wake Forest University. I thank you all for joining us. Let me start by what we are hearing from a number of people based on President Bush's nomination. And most loudly, perhaps, we are hearing from the Hispanic community. That was, quite frankly, I think, in many instances, looking for this to be their time, as African Americans did some years ago, based on what had been talked about politically and the growing political and social might of the Hispanic community. Jeff Obafemi Carr, were you surprised that we did not see a Hispanic name to this seat?
Well, no, I'm not surprised. I kind of expected that there would be a woman nominated, in this case, Myers, to fill the seat that's being left by O'Connor. I did not expect that a Hispanic person would be named. So I try with this administration not to have too many expectations, especially high expectations that there would be fairness across the board. But I also say that most people, I think most American people, are concerned with just having a little bit of freedom, justice, and equality across the board. And that's minus a political agenda and just interpreting the Constitution to be fair for everyone. And what happens is when you're in the minority, you don't feel as if there have been people there who represented your interest fairly and with equality and with justice in mind. So you look to have somebody who at least looks like you to represent you. And as we know that to be the case, it's kind of tough to use that as just a gold standard, because most people feel we still don't have an African-American on the court.
Well, As the comedian Sinbad says, you got to take the good with the bad. And, you know, if you're going to talk melanin, they're all included in that. Hey, Karen, let me ask you this. The Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, along with former president of the National Council of La Raza, and we can go down the list, have all expressed disappointment. Should minorities look to count seats and say, well, we should at least have one African-American seat, one Asian seat, one Hispanic seat, one female seat, et cetera, and we should note that females are not minorities? Go ahead, Karen.
Well, I would note that we actually haven't been advocating for an Asian American to be nominated because we're afraid of who they might nominate. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the president's decision shows that he's taking Latinos for granted, which is quite shocking given the rising number of voters and how the last election turned out. There were a number of Latinas who would have been well qualified for the position, so he could have had a woman and also a Latino at the same time, as well as you know, several African-American women were being discussed. I do think that minorities do have a right to say, just as women have, that, gee, you know, we need to have a diverse set of perspectives on this very important court, and the perspective, particularly that of immigrants, really is missing right now. I also find it very interesting that Laura Bush's influence is very clear on this, and yet none of the right who are vociferously complaining about this nomination is complaining about her. If Hillary had done this, you know, there would have been a field day on the right attacking her influence. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
Nat, what have your thought as relates to all of this, including the idea that often, I think, when minorities do vie for a seat and lobby for a seat, it almost, and I think this can be detrimental, locks you into, quote, the black seat, the female seat. In other words, when Thurgood Marshall retired, we knew, for instance, that we were probably going to get a black to fill that seat when a female steps away. So it almost locks you into that number of seats.
Well, I think that is a point. The you know, the downside of identity politics, that you can sometimes be confined to certain kinds of expectations. For example, the expectation that Clarence Thomas would be a lot more liberal than he has turned out to be. You know, it's turned out to be, a false expectation. And I don't think it is the way that we should be thinking about the court, although I do agree, however, as I heard Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg speak recently here at Wake Forest University, that a person's background on the court, the diversity of opinions, the diversity of background, is an important part of the deliberations of constitutional law, and that having people on the court who come from different have different eras of our history, different times, for example, coming up during the, she spoke of having grown up during the McCarthy era and how important it was to her later as she thought about the issues that came before her as a judge and then later as a Supreme Court justice. I do think, though, that in terms of the Latinos, the point here is, in terms of from a political standpoint, the president didn't take them any more for granted than he did his own conservative base. After all, I mean, I don't think it necessarily means because the Latinos don't, quote, have a Latino person on the court that it means that they're not going to suddenly become Democrats. And the other thing is, why would you blame necessarily Bush for the fact that there are is not a Latino in the court? Why not blame the right-wing party, the right-wing extremists within the Republican Party? That, after all, they were the ones who early on made it clear that they did not want Alberto Gonzalez to serve on the court. So the president, I think, gets a pass on this. Because we don't have Latinos, doesn't mean that the Republicans are going to get any more votes Democrats are going to get any more votes.
I disagree. I don't think the president gets a pass on this because the president had two opportunities. And I think he got a pass on Roberts because everybody, even before Rehnquist passed, everybody knew there was going to be at least one more nominee. I think, you know, unlike the conservative base, where are they going to go? They're not going to vote for a Democrat. Mm-hmm. The Latinos still have a choice. I mean, I believe, like the Asian community, they're still pretty unformed in terms of their loyalties to either party. So it's a community up for grabs, and the fact that the president hasn't tried to lock down that community, I think, is a big mistake.
And I would chime in that the Latino community is definitely a sleeping giant, and I would agree with what Karen said. They are definitely developing into a stronger political force, and I think Bush got about 40% of their vote after getting 35% the first time around, so I would think that he would have taken this opportunity. I didn't have the expectation that he would, but I thought that he did have a couple of opportunities to at least reach out. You run the risk, though, in the end, of having negative fallout. We talk about the wisdom that's manifest in the hip-hop analogy of Chuck D when he said, every brother ain't a brother 'cause of color, just as well could be undercover. We look at what the backlash was from the black community when we expected that Thurgood Marshall's seat would be filled by an African-American. And so they came with the Clarence Thomas type figure. And on the surface, he was an African-American. But does he bring the same sensibilities to the table and the same experiences to the table that an African-American who has dealt with segregation, an African-American who has dealt with discrimination and said, basically, this is something that is unfair. This country needs some equality and some justice. Does he bring that same sensibility, or does he bring a sensibility that says, hey, none of this matters. I've pulled myself up by my bootstraps, and therefore I can turn my back on what many African-Americans feel are important issues. So the same thing could have happened by supporting and putting somebody in place who was, yes, a Hispanic, yes, a Latino, but did not keep the sensibilities of the Latino struggle in America in mind.
Well, but Jeff, see, here's the problem with that. The Democrats were the ones who, I think, now, unless I'm mistaken, I think that they were the ones who were opposed to Miguel Estrada, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And the whole point would be here, this is the point I'm making here, that because the Latino population may be, some aspects of the Latino community may be disappointed that they did not get an appointment to the court, doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to become Democrats. Because you have to have an alternative. That's what I think is so interesting about this decision, about this appointment, is it's neither left nor right. You have the confusion on both the left and the right. You have the confusion among the Republicans and Democrats. Nobody knows exactly. It doesn't necessarily have to be a matter of left or right. It has to be, it seems to me, a matter of values, experiences that the person brings to the court. So I don't see that necessarily it means that the Democrats gain anything because the president didn't appoint a Latino. He did appoint a Latino, and the Democrats were the ones who turned it down. So what do you say about the conservative members of the Latino community who thought that he would have been a great candidate for the federal judiciary?
Well, yeah. But again, though, but it just puts the community up in play. And I think the right...
I agree with that.
I'm surprised because I think, you know, President Cheney has just said that Myers is just like Thomas and Scalia. So
Vice President Cheney?
Yeah.
that was
sorry.
Cute. I like that.
I heard that.
Yeah, so slip. But that I think that the opposition from the right is going to fall away. And quite frankly, for this nomination in the Senate, it's a Senate vote. They don't really need the right to be working it. The opposition from the left is going to be a challenging one because there is no paper record, and it probably likely that there isn't going to be much of one for us to work with. So, you know, with all that said, I think that it was pretty clever choice on the president's part.
I would agree, Karen.
Go ahead, real quick for me.
No, I was going to say, Karen brought another element into it, and that's the politics of it, and that is that she's a close political ally of George Bush. And we talked about, somebody mentioned earlier to me when we were in the studio that this was described as a brilliant choice. And so in the short term, it is brilliant for Bush's legacy. In the long term, though, it's going to be Myers' legacy, and we don't know how that's going to play out.
And I think it's kind of troubling because there hasn't really been as much focus on her closeness to the president, except, you know, the cronyism charge. Mm-hmm. But I think that the reality in terms of the fact that she's been White House counsel, she's going to be ruling on challenges to his policies, like on the many Patriot Act civil liberties issues that will be coming through the court. And that's what's troubling to me. I think the other interesting thing is he picked someone who's 60 years old. And up until now, the focus, the strategy has been to really pick much younger attorneys who are going to be much more likely to be on the court for a long, long time. So I think it says something about the tightness of this friendship that he decided to go that route.
Nat Ervin, does it say anything about the pool of candidates that they were looking at in the sense that this woman was helping to vet these candidates, and obviously the president decided that she of that lot was the best of the group?
You know, there's something about vetting for the president that gets you, you get to be vice president of the United States, and now you get to be nominated to the Supreme Court. I don't know exactly how this works, but I think that it does illustrate, it does illustrate how this president makes decisions. You know, there are some reports that Vice President Dick Cheney did not know of this decision, that the president kept this pretty close to himself, mm-hmm. that he found out, as did others, through his press secretary about who this nominee would actually be. But I think it reflects in a larger context something politically here, and that is that perhaps the president is starting to feel a little bit isolated because those who have talked him into going into Iraq, maybe he feels betrayed by all of this, and this is one way to kind of stick it back at him. You know, he made this decision himself, apparently kept it close to himself. Yeah. The right wing of the party certainly didn't know anything about it. So loyalty does have its rewards, doesn't it?
Well, we'll continue to watch this situation, obviously, as we move toward the Senate confirmation hearings. Let's turn our attention now to Darfur. And it is a region in the Sudan that we've been looking at and reporting on for some time. Last week, an announcement was made by the United Nations that suggested that if the violence continues to escalate, they may indeed have to pull their peacekeeping troops and efforts out of that region. Jeff, in fact, if this happens, we are looking at a region that is already in dire straits. One has to think about what will become of the people of that region if, in fact, this happens.
Yeah, this is another one of those global issues where we have to ask what's really, really important. And in this case, in Darfur, it's really important that there be a peacekeeping force there. And whatever it might take to keep the force there, we need that. And we've got almost 200,000 people have already died in these conflicts. And the Justice and Equality Movement and Sudanese Liberation Movement and the government, I think they're going to have to come together to stop this. But I think the UN also has a commitment and has to keep a commitment to not create an if-then kind of ultimatum and say we're going to pull out. We have to find new and creative ways to support life in that region and to support sustaining the people, the 2 million people that are getting help right now from that peacekeeping force.
Mm-hmm. Karen, what have the thought of the... Go ahead, Nat, and I'll pick up with
Karen. I was just going to say that, you know, reading this report, it just tells you how far we have come from last September when then-Secretary Colin Powell had given a speech about the very positive prospects for peace to actually occur in the Sudan. And now here we are faced with having to reiterate the saying of never again, which, you know, haunts back to Rwanda situation, the genocide in Rwanda. But I think the way, you know, we think about this, this is one of the downsides of having gone foolishly into Iraq. If you were to ask the American people, are you in favor of sending any American troops into the Sudan, either on the left or on the right, I'd say that you'd get very few people who would support that. Even if you're trying to prevent terrorism, the spread of terrorism, and promote the spread of democracy, as the president once said that he was in favor of, what this says to me is that we lack the will to do this. We lack the will to intercede on to stop the genocide. We don't know how to do it. The UN doesn't have the sufficient resources. I don't know. I suppose that the UN has the will, but it still remains to be seen. I think that there's a very good likelihood that we're going to see the emergence of genocide is going to go unchecked. A few years from now, we're going to be left with saying never again, again. This is a horrible time in American history, world history. And I think in some way we have to say that it reflects the downsides of having foolishly gone into Iraq.
And Karen, that was what I was going to ask with a little less than a minute to go. The idea that when Colin Powell was there, we did hear of this region. It's been conspicuously silent since then. Can the Bush administration afford to allow this to get even anywhere near what we saw in Rwanda some years ago?
I think it's a continuing fault of the administration in not paying enough attention to Africa generally. They've spent a lot of their political capital talking about AIDS, but not talking about genocide. And I find that, you know, that is going to end up being a serious, serious mistake.
Yeah. All right. Karen Narasaki, Jeff Obafemi-Carr, and Nat Irvin, I thank you all for being with us today. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.